Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I hope everybody can hear me through the mic. Can everybody hear me in the back? Thank you, and welcome on behalf of the Chartered Institute of Taxation and the Institute of Fiscal Studies to this fringe event on the, I think, very topical subject of the rise in self-employment in the gig economy. This is actually the fifth time, I think, that our two institutes have collaborated at the fringe events at Harvard conferences in the interest of promoting better understanding of sort of tax policy and fiscal policy in general. My name is John Preston. I'm the president of the Chartered Institute of Taxation, and it's my pleasure to act as your chairman for this evening. And as I say, I'm delighted that we have a topic which I think is getting sort of almost more topical by the minute, let alone by the week. And so I'm sure that our speakers this evening will have a number of different perspectives on the topic for you to hear. The format is we're going to ask each of them to speak, and then after that we will have a series of questions. I'm probably going to take questions in sort of groups of two or three. We will have roving mics going around, so if I could ask you at the end to wait till the mic reaches you. Our speakers for this evening are Damien Hirst, the Minister of State for Employment. We have Claire Hooper from the Chartered Institute of Taxation and Ernst & Young. But our first speaker this evening is... I'm just not doing it at all today. Who has been for 6 years the director for the Institute of Fiscal Studies. Before that, he had spells at the Treasury Department of Education and the FSA. So, ladies and gentlemen, Paul Johnson.
The fact Robert Preston for that introduction. I'm just going to say, thank you very much, I'm just going to say a few words about how the number of people who are self-employed and company owner managers have changed relative to the number of full-time employees, and then a little bit about the taxation of this group and what we might think of as the right way of taxing them. But let me start with this this chart, which is the good news, as it were, about the last 7 or 8 years, which is that the number of people in work has grown really quite substantially and quite astonishingly in a way, given how poor economic performance has been. So if you start this at the beginning of 2008, we've got about 1.5 million more people in standard forms of employment than we had back then, and most of that is an increase in full-time work. But we've also got quite a big increase in numbers of people who are self-employed and company owner-managers, the two bits on top there, and indeed 40%. So in total, we've actually got more than 2 million more people either in work or who are self-employed or who are company owner-managers over the period since 2008. So again, in terms of the performance of the labour market, that's pretty remarkable and gives some of the only really good economic news that we've had over that period. But that increase, that fraction, that 40% of the increase, which are self-employed people, company owner managers, is a very large fraction, because at the baseline, about 85% of people are employees, only about 85% of those in work are employees, only about 15% are company owner managers or self-employed. But consequently, a much larger fraction of the growth in work over the last decade or so has been not among normal employees, but among these self-employed individuals. So whilst that leaves us still with the vast majority of people who are in work are employees, the change is very much focused on the self-employed. That matters for all sorts of reasons. That matters for all sorts of reasons associated with the kinds of employment protection that people have, the relationship they have with the state, the relationship, the degree of certainty they have about their income going forward. But for the purpose of my presentation, it also matters for tax. And what I'm going to put up here is just one example of how it managed matters for tax. So what I'm going to show you here is how much tax is paid on a job generating £40,000. So you've got an employee, you've got a self-employed person, you've got an owner-manager, and as you can see, employees get hit for an awful lot more tax than self-employed people or owner-managers. Most of that, in fact all of that, is to do with the national insurance system. If you're an employee, then for your employer, if your employer is spending £40,000 on you, then the employer is paying an awful lot of national insurance contributions, and so are you, as well as income tax. If you're self-employed, there are no employer national insurance contributions and a lower rate of self-employed national insurance. And then the owner-manager is a more complex thing. In a way, what we've done there is be quite generous in the comparison, as it were. We have not taken account, for example, of the possibilities of taking returns in capital gains or using entrepreneurs relief or anything like that. But the difference there is really quite substantial. So, and that really matters for the exchequer. So you're, if the self-employed were taxed the same as employees, we'd get an extra 5 billion a year in tax. If company owner managers were taxed the same, we'd get an extra 6 billion. So that's 11 billion less in tax revenue than you might expect. And then the average amounts are quite different. That very big number for the owner-managers reflects a small number of owner-managers who have very, very large incomes indeed. I mean, that's an HMRC number, which may be a slight overstatement relative to what the counterfactual might be. But again, the point is that there's a very big difference there in the way that these people are taxed. And that will clearly have an impact on behaviour. Now, this isn't new. These lines show tax due on someone making £40,000 over time, and you can see that the gap between the self-employed and employees is pretty constant over time, and if anything, maybe getting a little bit lower. But the key point here for the Treasury is that because the expectation is that the number of self-employed is going to grow over time, if we continue to see this growth in self-employment, which is bigger than the growth in employees, and that's clearly related to what's happening in the gig, so-called gig economy, and whatever might happen to Uber, the Treasury reckons that they'll lose an additional nearly £5 billion by 2021. So that's essentially saying if the growth in employment, if the growth in the numbers of workers was just proportional to the numbers who are currently self-employed, we'd get an extra £4.5 billion a year in tax. But because the expectation is that something like 40% of the growth in jobs will be among the self-employed, the Treasury will be £4.5 billion worse off than it otherwise would have been. And that's a pretty big number in the context of these changes. Now, of course, that was exactly what the Chancellor was trying to make some difference to in his March budget, when he was planning to put a small increase on the national insurance contributions paid by the self-employed. Now, this chart is just looking at national insurance contributions, and it's showing how much is paid on the earnings of an employee and on the earnings of a self-employed person as their income goes up. And again, you can see the difference is very big indeed, largely but not entirely, because if you're self-employed, there are no employer national insurance contributions. What the Chancellor was proposing would have made that much difference, which is, you can see, closing just a little bit of the gap. But even that small increase didn't get the support, enough support in Parliament, actually, to happen. So the question, of course, then arises, if you can't make that kind of relatively small change to bring the two things together, what can you do? And let me just stress, this matters not just because of the what you might take of as a prima facie unfairness, in the sense that employees just pay a lot more tax, they are penalised by the tax system, but it also matters because that provides an enormous incentive for employees and employers to pretend that people are not employees, that they are actually self-employed or incorporated. see the enormous effort that some companies, and not just Uber, go to make it clear that the people working with them are not employees, they are not workers, and part of the reason for that is because there is a very big tax advantage to doing it, and no doubt part of the reason for the big increase in the fraction of the workforce who are self-employed is because there is that big difference. The Taylor Review, Matthew Taylor's review of the whole gig economy issue, came to this conclusion: situation is not justified or sustainable, it's not conducive to the goal of a good work economy. That difference between the way that the state treats or the way that HMRC treats people doing very often similar jobs but in different legal forms. So what about the arguments for those differences? Now, one argument that really doesn't fly is the idea that the lower tax or lower national insurance contributions reflect the lower benefits that the self-employed get. There's very, very little difference in terms of the benefits that the self-employed can get. They basically, the big difference used to be that employees accrued rights to the earnings-related pension and the self-employed didn't. That no longer applies. So even if that were a serious point, it no longer is an issue. Now, there are small benefits here, statutory job seekers allowance and some parental benefits, but they account in terms of money terms for less than one percentage point difference. So as you saw, there was something like a 14 percentage point difference. About one percentage point of that you can justify in terms of different benefits. What about the fact that employees have employment rights and self-employed and so on don't? Now, that at face value sounds like quite a good argument for treating the self-employed differently. Self-employed don't get holiday pay, they don't get sick pay, so isn't it just reasonable that they pay less in the way of tax, as they're penalised in one sense, let's benefit them through the tax system. But that argument really doesn't work. Employment rights aren't a transfer from government to employee, they're a transfer from employers to employees. So they make employment more attractive to the employee. So if you're an employee, you want to be employed because you're going to get the sick pay and so on. So a higher tax rate might offset that. So that's the main argument. But there's two sides to this relationship. The employer, that makes employment a less attractive proposition from the point of view of the employer, and the higher tax reinforces that. So the employee benefits from the sick pay, the holiday pay, and the employment rights. The employer, that's an extra cost on them, and then you put tax on top. So it's not surprising, in a sense, that many employers are looking to use the difference in the tax system to pretend that people who are actually employees are no such thing. There's no net benefit to employment for tax to offset it in this case. So it's not a good argument to have a lower rate of tax because of these different employment rights. The employment rights offer something to the employee, but they offer an extra cost to the employer, and the tax adds to that cost from the employer. What about this other issue? We want risk taking, we want entrepreneurship in the economy, that's absolutely right, but why use an across the board tax benefit for that? Millions of these people who are self-employed are doing absolutely the right job, they are doing things that are good for the economy, but they are not in any sense entrepreneurs. 40,000 Uber drivers in London are no more entrepreneurs than people who are employed as taxi drivers. I shouldn't keep using Uber as the example, but self-employed plumbers and lawyers and all sorts of other people who are self-employed are essentially doing exactly the same job as someone who is an employee. They are not offering anything additional in terms of entrepreneurship. If there are forms of entrepreneurship that we want to support, then we need to find better ways of doing that, supporting innovation, startups, investment, supporting those on low incomes. None of that is an argument for a different way of treating the self-employed as a whole. So there are ways of getting to better answers to this. it's not obvious what the policy aim is of having this very different tax system for the self-employed. What we really want to do is align the treatment of the employees and self-employed in a way which doesn't reduce investment. So rather than making sharper boundaries between legal forms, so one legal answer to this is to say, let's be absolutely clear that this thing is self-employed and this thing is employee. That never works, because when you've got that great big tax wedge between the two, you'll always find that that doesn't work. What you want to do is align the marginal rates, but in a way which doesn't distort investment. And you can do that essentially by charging, by offsetting all costs, all employment costs for self-employed and the incorporated, but charge the same marginal rate as you charge on employees. The key thing here is you need to separate tax issues from employment rights issues, get the tax system right and get the employment rights system right, not pretend that the two are closely related. They really shouldn't be. And so long as we have this enormous difference in the way that we tax people, we will continue to have people taking advantage of that and distorting the way that the economy works. Thank you.
Paul, thank you very much indeed. Our second speaker this evening is Claire Hooper. Claire is a tax partner with Ernst & Young with over 20 years' experience in both UK and international tax. She's currently chair of EY's Knowledge and Policy. Thank you. Shiltu is a member of the COT Council and chairs our corporate tax network. So, Claire.
Thank you. Right, so Paul has already shown to us that there's this big tax differential depending on whether somebody's an employee, self-employed, or providing services to a company. I'm not going to go through these numbers because Paul's already shown that difference. But what that does mean is there is an incentive for people to structure something that would otherwise be structured as employment as a self-employment or providing services through a company. So whilst we are seeing a change in the economy towards more self-employment, there are also tax reasons for people to want to structure things more like self-employment. But it's not just about the tax differential. We've seen a number of high-profile cases recently, haven't we, around the benefits that can be derived from that as well. But a key question is, should there be a different tax treatment? And if so, and should it change from what we have currently? So in answering this, I think there are a number of questions we need to ask. Firstly, should there be a different tax treatment at all? Well, it seems to me that if you've got two people doing exactly the same job, having the same benefits, the same rights, taking the same risks, then they should have the same tax treatment. But I do think there is a distinction between an employee on one hand and somebody, and an entrepreneur, a true self-employed entrepreneur on the other hand. And the tax system has, over many years, recognised that different treatment. So why is this becoming an issue now? Because really we always had this as a point. I think it's becoming an issue because the poll showed the number of people structuring as self-employed or through a company is increasing. And why is that? So traditionally, and in most cases still, the way the power and effort of a lot of individuals is harnessed towards a common goal has been through employment contracts. Employer has sought to employ lots of people and then direct them on how they should act. But now you can use technology to get access to those same individuals and to harness their power collectively. So there's still somebody providing quite a bit of control over those individuals, but using technology instead of an employment contract to harness that benefit. But that can lead to different tax treatments, so should that be changed. So many would argue that yes, it should. The line needs to be redrawn in some way. So there are currently three categories for employment law purposes. We've got the employed, we've got the self-employed, and in between that we have this worker category. But for tax purposes, we only have two categories. We have employed or self-employed. Now, the Taylor report, which has already been mentioned, recommended expanding what's included in that worker category. So instead of it being, to place more emphasis on that control that's being provided by the contractor. So where that is that degree of control, then in fact they should be treated the same way as an employee in many cases, but this is worker category. She changed its name to be called dependent contractor, but actually a lot of the benefits that an employee would get would also come to that dependent contractor. Now, tax wasn't in the scope of his report. However, it's so intertwined in the problem, he didn't feel it could be left aside. And so he again said, actually, that dependent contractor position, they should also be taxed the same way as an employee. So if that was done, that would address much of the issue. But what about those operating through a company? As we saw, they're the ones that actually get the most benefit. Well, I still think that could actually have a knock-on consequence there, because we have some anti-avoidance rules that currently say if somebody is providing services to a company, but if they've been providing them directly, they're essentially going to be taxed the same way as if they were an employee. So those rules could easily be adapted to say, well, if you're providing services to a company but would otherwise be a dependent contractor, well, you should be taxed the same as a dependent contractor, and if that was then taxed the same as an employee, taxed that way as well. Now, the problem with that is compliance, and I'll come back to that a little bit later. So that would address the dependent contractors. Now, some people would say, well, that's only part of the problem. We should tax everyone the same, all self-employed, the same as employees. So there's two elements to that, as Paul was showing. There's currently the difference between the employee national insurance level and the self-employed national insurance level. That was what was tried to address in the budget. But many would argue that that's a sensible thing to do, politics aside. But that still leaves the bigger issue of the employer national insurance. So if we say, okay, well, we need to address that problem, how are we actually going to do that? Should the contractor deduct an amount equivalent to employer national insurance from the payment? Well, the problem with that is if you're paying a contractor, it's not just for the labour time, but they've also incurred a lot of expenses. They've invested in some equipment. They might have bought a car, for example. And if they're working for a number of different contractors, how are you going to deal with those expenses? There's just some practical issues around how you're going to do that. Now, you could have mechanisms to true it up, yeah? So I kind of think that's doable, but there's quite a compliance burden with it. So you might kind of go, well, actually, well, let's put the onus on the individual. Maybe they should complete a tax return to make sure they're paying the same amount as an employee at the end of the day. Now, I mentioned earlier the anti-avoidance rules we have when somebody is operating through a company. HMRC's estimates is that only 10% of people that should be applying those rules are actually applying them. 10%. So there's no point coming up with a great policy idea that we all think makes sense if actually in practice it doesn't work. So we need a policy that's going to work in practice, and that doesn't seem like it does to me. So maybe there's something in between, some type of withholding tax that's not quite as high, because it allows for the fact there'll be expenses, and you could have some true-ups at the end, but at least it makes sure you're getting a certain amount of the tax in. But others would say, actually, maybe we should just scrap employer national insurance altogether, and increase the rate of increase the rate of self-employed national insurance. But that actually makes the problem worse. As we saw from the table at the beginning of Paul's slides, all that does is encourage people to provide the services to the company. So that on its own doesn't solve the problem. So others have said, well, let's decouple it. Let's get rid of employer national insurance and have some other type of tax, like a social contribution tax. So based on all the inputs. So I think it's great that we have these options. I think we need as many options as we can, but it is with its challenges. You get issues of double tax if you subcontract some of the services, or if you've got workers coming from abroad, we kind of have rules to make sure you're not paying social security in too many territories. How would it interact with all of that? So again, it's not without its challenges. So perhaps you say again, okay, let's scrap employer national insurance and raise the rate of corporation tax. But the problem with that is we operate in a global environment. We need a lower corporation tax rate to remain competitive. We've seen the lowering of the corporation tax. More business has come to the UK as a result. They pay the corporation tax here, but more importantly, they employ people here, and that generates tax on employment, but also other taxes as well. So I think what you can see is there are a number of options. I haven't covered them all, but there's quite a lot of options, but none of them, to my mind, are kind of like the perfect solution. There's pros and cons in all of them, and I think what we need is a debate around which is the best, and the public debate, so they can understand when a policy choice is made, why that decision is made, and although it's not perfect, why it's kind of the best in the situation. Mr. Slide. Oh, slide's gone. In my missing slide, I was just going to say, actually, that it's not just about where your end goal is, it's about the transition to that, because we also need to make sure we're not, there's not too much hardship happening in the interim to move that, because the mechanism with which we make a change might be to put the burden on one party, but actually the person who's benefited from the lower tax beforehand might be another person, and the bargaining power between the two might not mean it quite ends up in the right place. So introducing a change in one go is going to be an issue. And I think what we need is a long-term plan of where we want to end up with interim steps along the way to help us get there. And we need to look at all of that against questions like, you know, does it give the right answer? Is it fair? Is it actually going to work? Are we going to have a high degree of compliance? Are the compliance costs going to be really high? How's it going to impact the competitiveness of the UK? So I think what we need is a public debate for a long-term plan and interim steps. And I look forward to that debate.
Many thanks, Claire. I should say, we originally hoped we would have four speakers this evening. Unfortunately, Sarah O'Connor from the Financial Times is ill today, and therefore she sends her apologies for not being able to be here. So we now turn to our final speaker of the evening. This is actually his second time speaking at an IFS CRT Fringe event. 2 years ago, in this very hotel, when he was a Treasury Minister, he spoke at an event on the subject of sort of fairness in taxation. But sort of a promotion later, he is now the Minister of State of the Department of Work and Pensions, responsible for employment issues. And we're delighted that he's here to speak to us this evening. I'll get his name right this time, Damon Hines.
Thank you. And I still believe in fairness. Just to be... I've got any slides. Can we press B?
B? Okay.
Yeah. B should make it go black.
Ah.
There we go. Well, so, ladies and gentlemen, I have no slides. You only have me. Those of you who were in the hall earlier this morning will have heard from either Chancellor or from David Gort, my boss, some pretty impressive numbers on employment. Even if you were there, and even if you did hear it, I'm going to repeat them, because they're important. We have a higher rate of employment than the United States of America, and we've got half the rate of unemployment of the euro area. Now, these things are worth repeating, because there is a danger that we take them for granted. There's a danger that we let people just bank them and forget that this only comes about with the economic management, with the investment-friendly approach, and with the active labour market policies that you get with a Conservative government. And it would all be thrown away in the event of our political opponents getting into power. Let's just unpack those numbers a little bit more in terms of some of the segments. We've got a record level of female employment and a record low gender employment gap. Over the last 4 years, the number of disabled people in work has increased by 596,000. There's still much more to do, but it's a great start. In terms of young people, the proportion of 16 to 24s who are not in further education and are unemployed has just dropped below 5% for the first time since that data series began. Overall, 3.1 million jobs have been created in this country. Ladies and gentlemen, these things are not to be sniffed at. They are part of an exceptionally strong story that we've had in employment growth. There is still more to do, of course. There is still more to do in terms of driving forward productivity and the real wages that flow from that. And indeed, reaching out further to segments who have for too long had disadvantage in the labour market to make sure that all possible opportunities are open to them. But the employment story is a good one. It also tells you something about some of the other changes that have been going on in society. So with that record rate of female employment, there are more women coming into the labour market, clearly. And there are more women coming back into the labour market after a period away. There are also more people in the workforce who have caring responsibilities, both caring for children, but also caring for spouses and indeed sometimes caring for one's own parents. There is therefore, from some, a demand, a requirement for more part-time and flexible work, and all of this is relevant to today's discussion. There are also changes in the structure of the economy, which have been coming for some time. A long-term sectoral shift from manufacturing to services, the famous and clichéd end of jobs for life, and of course all the changes that technology may bring, with all the possibilities and the challenges that come with artificial intelligence and advanced manufacturing, voice computing, facial recognition, and so on. A huge amount of change. Some people talk to all that unprecedented rate of change. I'm not quite sure it's unprecedented when you compare it to some things that have happened in history, but it is certainly very rapid, and for public policy raises a lot of questions. Our default position, of course, should not be fear, because there is also a great deal of opportunity to come from these changes. So on top of all that, yes, we've seen a growth in self-employment. Actually, self-employment has been a growing part of the labour market for most of the last 30 years. And for most people going into self-employment, that is, of course, a positive choice. And when I talked about the changing composition of the labour force, it's also true that sometimes when we talk about proportions, we need to remember it's not always a like-for-like comparison that we're making when we talk about the proportion of the overall labour market, which is self-employed. We also shouldn't get too carried away. 84% of jobs in this country are still employed, not self-employed. And particularly over the last year, if you look at the growth in employment, first of all, most of it has been in employment rather than self-employment. And contrary to what message you may pick up listening to certain politicians, it has been overwhelmingly about full-time work and about permanent positions. So there is this growth in self-employment, and there's also the more modern, more recent phenomenon to many people of the growth in the so-called gig economy or platform economy. Actually, I'm going to suggest it's not quite as new as is made out. Because if you think about all the different forms of non-standard employment and different ways of working, from franchising to licensing, casual labour, piecework, commission-only sales, the agency catalogue model, all of these, to a greater or lesser extent, have some things in common with what we now call the gig or platform economy. What sort of turbocharges the potential for gig or platform is technology, both directly, because it makes possible the app, it makes possible the system that enables you to sign up for pieces of work. There's also an indirect effect, because one of the things that the internet has done has been to grow the market massively for home delivery. And it so happens that one of the big segments for home delivery is in turn this, this gig or platform economy. But it also comes together with some of these demographic changes and some of the demand, some of the requirement for having more flexible employment. A really important thing to know is that most people working in the gig economy have another job as well. For the majority of people, the gig work is not their sole or primary source of income. And in a survey in 2016, the consultants McKinsey & Co. Found that somewhere in the range of 10 to 14% of people working in those types of jobs both had it as their main source of income and were doing it, and they felt they didn't have an alternative. So for the others, either it was an additional role or it was a very sort of active choice. And I say the range 10 to 14% because they carried out the study in different countries. And it turned out the figures were remarkably similar, whether you look at the United States or France or Germany or the UK. And indeed, many of these trends that I've spoken about, greater female participation, the ageing of the population, the effect of technology, they are not only affecting our country, they are they're phenomena much wider than that. So what about the, what is the policy response? I'm not going to talk about tax. There's been a good opportunity to talk about a lot of the taxation issues, and they may come up in questions. But in terms of the overall sort of labour market policy response to this, first of all, we need to recognise the value of self-employment. First of all, as a choice that many people have made. And secondly, in its potential to increase the inclusivity of the labour market, to enable people to work who may not otherwise have been able to work at all, and to enable others to work in the way that they want to, when in other forms of work it may not have been as conducive to other things going on in their lives. And with the gig economy and platform economy, not exactly the same thing, but heavily overlapping, we've always been a country that has recognised that change comes, you must embrace it, you must do the very best from it, and to try and see the possibilities while also making sure that we're on top of the concerns that people have and making sure that we have the appropriate frameworks in place to deal with that. Clearly it's very important to try and make sure that people understand the risks of whatever they may take on. I think that's a really, really important point. If you're entering some form of business that involves a cost to you or a commitment of some sort, it's really important that people are properly made aware of that. But also more broadly, we need to think about the balance of rights and responsibilities, representation, and making sure that underrepresented groups can have their opportunities enhanced and so on. And that was at the heart of the Prime Minister commissioning Matthew Taylor to do his review into modern employment practices. It's relatively recent, but Matthew's report came out, and the government is currently considering it and will respond in due course. But let me say a couple of other things briefly about public policy and self-employment and what is happening. And Paul mentioned, you know, that self-employment and entrepreneurship are not exactly the same thing. There are lots of self-employed people who are entrepreneurs, and there are lots of entrepreneurs who are self-employed, but they are not exactly the same thing. There is also a big area where that's not the case, where people are not creating or developing a business in the sense that most people in the street would understand those terms. But for those that are, it's really important that we have a framework that allows people to realise that opportunity, that we have in our economy the ability to let innovation happen, let business growth happen, and job creation happen. And so we have things like startup loans available. And through the Job Centre Network, the New Enterprise Allowance, which puts people in touch with a mentor, also provides some financial support and other types of advice and gateways and signposting to other services to help them in the initial stages of the business. More recently, we've further developed the New Enterprise Allowance with the introduction at the start of a special workshop called Link Up Startup, which is specifically there to help people to think through both the cons and the pros of being self-employed. What is the reality of being self-employed? And to help people to make that as active a choice as possible. We've also increased the mentoring period from 8 weeks to 12, and doubling the length of post-trading support that goes on. From April of this year, we've also introduced a version without the additional financial support, but with the mentoring elements for people on universal credit who are already self-employed but are have lower earnings from self-employment to help with ways of further developing their work in order to get their earnings up. Overall, universal credit, I mean, is a huge reform to the way we do welfare, social security, and in-work support in this country. It's also designed around the different ways that people do work these days, and it takes full account of the existence of self-employment. And unlike the tax credit system, which, as you know, was an annual system, where you have to make an adjustment at the end of the year, depending on what's happened. Of course, for a lot of self-employed people, there is, you know, trading and earnings will change through the year. Universal credit adjusts on a month-by-month basis. We also, in universal credit, fully accept that businesses can take time to ramp up, and so there's a period of time of 12 months during which there's additional support is possible. After that, we would expect that it's right that people should be earning, at least be able to pay themselves the legal minimum in their self-employment. So, in summary, I would say yes, there's been growth in self-employment. It's not just a phenomenon in this country. There are kind of structural reasons for it, and I accept that there are fiscal issues as well. But it's not necessarily all about that. There are also things about the ways that people want to work, and more recently, about technology. Often it's a positive choice. It can enable more people to come into work, and has formed part of this success story of 3.1 million more people in work. But of course we need to think about rights and responsibilities. We need to make sure that there are proper protections and proper help in place, and I believe that's what the government is doing.
Damien, many thanks indeed. We now have about half an hour left for questions. As I say, I'm going to try and take them in sort of groups of two or three. We have at least one roving mic. We have another one at the back. So if I could ask you, please, just to wait till you do get the mic before we speak. There's a gentleman at the back. Harry?
Cheers. Pete Smore, the Washington Pinner. I just wondered if one of the big issues we face is the policing of how we tax, in the sense of how much we take in. It's not just about like changing rates or trying to lower rates. And I think we sometimes forget the massive risk that self-employed people take. First of all, they tend to be happier, even the ones that are earning less, doing less hours, because they may have childcare responsibilities. You know, you speak to construction workers where self-employment is, because they're on site to site, a flexible industry. They tend to be a lot happier. And if you try to take them away from that and put them into some structured type of employment, although some like that, they probably tell you to jog on, because they quite like leaving at 4 o'clock, and they quite like going to the pub, and they are quite highly skilled. Is it not about policing the taxation that we take? Because often there is a missed amount of money to the Treasury that we've been talking about for years, rather than just trying to close nicks and do all that stuff. Is it not a big issue around policing, but also appreciating that the self-employed generally seem to be a happier bunch of people than that? It's interesting that whenever the trade unions do work on this, they tend not to ask the question about whether you're happy or unhappy in the work that they do, because they know the answer is self-employed people are generally more happy at work than self-employed people, but it is important that we do realise that there is some types of exploitation, but it's all not muddled in as one.
Thank you. I should have said, and thank you for doing it, if you could kindly introduce yourself when you do. Lady there in the third row.
Is that me?
Yes.
I'm Katie Benson, I'm from Sky Betting and Gaming. One of the big changes I think that we've possibly not touched on is the change in public sector work, which doesn't affect you directly, but obviously now if you've got owner-managed businesses, they're engaged by the public sector. The public sector body now has a requirement to deduct and withhold and pay employers NICs in certain circumstances as well. Isn't that just a model to go for? Why just you do that in public sector? Let's just extend it to private sector, do what Australia do, and you've got yourself £4 or 5 billion. Is that not the easy way?
Take one more just here with Heather, and then we'll come back, I promise.
Heather Self from Prince & Masons. The previous question related to what's known as IR35, which was introduced under a previous administration in about 2000 when I happened to be chair of the CIOT's technical committee. And the idea of that is that if you engage someone who's really an employee, they should account for tax in the right way. What's changed with public sector is that responsibility has passed to the public sector. That shouldn't mean they automatically deduct pay as you earn. They should actually decide whether someone is genuinely self-employed. And I think to go back to Claire's point, isn't part of the problem failure to enforce the law we have, as well as a potential need for change? So could I ask the panel, how could we make sure the law we already have is enforced properly before we start changing it?
So, thank you. Claire, perhaps I can start. I did promise I'd give you an easy one to start with, inside the line. But can I come to you perhaps on this subject of policing and how you would make the...
Yeah, so there's a few different points there, aren't there? So the first point around retaining that flexibility, I think that is absolutely essential. One of the benefits of the UK market is the flexibility in workforce. And so whatever is done, I think we don't want to destroy that flexibility. But I think it is about ensuring that the tax system doesn't distort incentives, and that we are collecting the right tax, which comes on to the enforcement point. So on those public sector workers, as I think Heather was kind of saying, that it doesn't really change the liability, it just changes whose job it is to make sure that the right amount is being paid. And it wouldn't surprise me if the government was sort of thinking, well, start with public sector and then we'll expand that to everybody. But there have been quite a few challenges. So, you know, some of the challenges is that we've seen people moving out of public sector because of those rules, and it's creating issues where you have chains of agencies and unscrupulous agents actually in the middle of that, causing a lot of issues. So I think the point is about actually getting the rules right in the first place. It kind of goes back to our point around the policy making. Let's make sure we get rules that give us the right answer but actually are enforceable to start with.
Jamie, do you have a...
So I'm not going to comment on the tax setups and so on. And I mean, I know IR35 in particular always generates, these kinds of meetings always generates a lot of discussion. I did want to come back to the gentleman in the back who was saying about people being more happy. I don't know quite where that data comes from, but I mean, I'd be slightly careful. There might be a confounding variable at work here. So one of the things you find is that some sectors have particularly high prevalences of... you know what I mean? Have a high prevalence of self-employment, and construction happens to be one of them. So it may be that construction is what makes people happy rather than self-employment. I don't know. But it does come back, I think, to the point about, you know, to the extent you can enable people to make positive choices that enable them to cope with the other things, the other responsibilities they have, childcare and caring for relatives is such an important part of it, then clearly that can be a really positive thing.
I'm not going to add very much more other than to say I agree, yes, it's really important we have labour market policy which gives people a degree of choice that they currently do have, and actually we're quite fortunate in the UK in the extent to which people have flexibility to make those choices. In terms of enforcement, look, you know, if you're going to have a system where when you're earning 40 grand, you could be, whatever it was, 10 grand better off by defining yourself in one way or the other, it doesn't matter how much rules you put around it. Of course people are going to try and take advantage of it. The only way, in the end, that you're going to get around that and police it properly is if you reduce that that gap between the way that you tax people. It may be that we're stuck in a fifth best world where you can't do that, but if it is, we need to recognise that we're in that world. We should surely be thinking about trying to get the tax rates more aligned, because, you know, however wonderful our legal HMRC and judicial system is, it's never going to be as wonderful as the people who can, you know, help you avoid lots and lots and lots and lots of tax when there's this, you know, this huge gulf you can drive your sort of tax avoidance bus through.
I purely personal basis, I'm going to break all the rules of chairmanship and just say, as the trustee of a charity which is responsible for promoting flexible working as part of a broader diversity initiative, I do think it's important to remember that you can actually get flexibility even within employment, although we entirely accept that obviously self-employment does it too. Further questions, please. Lady at the end there.
Hello, Carolyn McFarlane from Common Vision. We run the Responsible Tax Lab, which aims to build consensus on tax issues across sectors and perspectives. My question is on the relationship between policy making and public engagement. So the public get really angry about tax, and that has often provoked infamous U-turns and that sort of thing around these issues. And while experts might agree that we have a contradictory system and that perhaps George Osborne should have, you know, amended the self-employment rules when he amended the pension stuff, we are now in a situation where there will be kind of resistance to policy changes. And I think, Claire, you touched on this a bit, but how do we build acceptance and appetite and understanding for policy change, both on this topic and others? I know that IFS and CIOT have done stuff on good policy making, but what does good public engagement look like in that context?
Thank you. Gentleman here.
Oh. What does the panel think about building some sort of proportionality into it? I know lots of instances where people might employ a student for a day for the harvest or for a model or a filming industry. And, you know, you can't be spending hundreds and hundreds of pounds when you're only giving them 50 quid a day. You know? And you certainly can't be asking national insurance numbers and things. So, if there was a de minimis amount or a de minimis time period, if you employed for more than a couple of weeks or, you know, anything below that limit didn't have to be, could be treated just as casual labour and reported as such. I mean, that's quite interesting.
Thank you. Gentlemen there. Amen? Sorry.
Ryan Carana from the Consumer Choice Center. So one of the things that I got from practically everyone's speech was this kind of idea that employment is the default and self-employment is either chosen for personal reasons or because economic conditions warrant it. But from my perspective, it would be that people want to be self-employed, but there's some transaction costs to self-employment so that they join a firm because it takes things out of the market and internalizes the organization. My question is, like, the dependent contractor status and the tax policy that you've advocated, would that not add to the transaction costs and the barriers to being self-employed and therefore disincentivize self-employment in a way?
Thank you. Paul, perhaps I can start with you both on proportionality and that last point.
Wow, those were good and difficult questions. The question about how you build public engagement on tax policy is a really tough one, and actually it's a tough one across public and economic policy. I mean, essentially, I think that's what the Chancellor was talking about this morning, wasn't he? Not about tax policy, but about how you engage the public on the idea that the market economy is a good thing. How do you engage the public in terms of what is an appropriate tax policy? It's really tough, and I think it requires much more from people like us at the IFS and the CIOT explaining in very wide audiences how these things work and what's important. It also requires politicians from both sides, both government and opposition, to be more honest and open, which our public sort of debate makes really very difficult. The way in which tax policy is made is also, I think, less good than the way in which much other policy is made. There's less parliamentary scrutiny, there's less in the way of green papers and white papers and debate beforehand. And don't forget, the whole of government spending ought to be equal to the whole of government tax. But tax doesn't even get as much focus as one element of government spending. So I think we're a long, long way from being in a good place there. The way I really depress myself, there are lots of ways I depress myself, but one way I depress myself is to look back at the founding article, which was written by the people who started the IFS back in the late 1960s. And it's a big article in the Times in 1968 or something like that, setting out all the things that are wrong with the tax system and why an IFS was needed. And my God, it's familiar. Still, after all the nearly 50 years that we've had. So I don't know the answer to that question, but it is an incredibly important one. In terms of proportionality, again, a really tough one. I mean, I was told, not recently, but at one point by a senior HMRC official, that HMRC kind of does operate what they call a self-operated de minimis rule, in the sense that they kind of understand if you work for a day or two and don't declare it. Don't tell anyone. But formally, it's a hard thing to build in. In the VAT system, of course, we have something like that. We have a quite high threshold before you register for VAT, which is different from the income tax threshold, which is you just don't register below that. But that's obviously very advantageous for those who are below it in terms of simplicity. But it creates a big bunching of people who are or claim to be just below that threshold. So as soon as you introduce that, you introduce thresholds. You're in a world of trade-offs here. I don't think there's any getting around the trade-offs. In terms of if you change the taxes, you've got another disincentive to self-employment. I don't think so. I think the point here is, I think it's hard to think why you would put into the tax system a great big incentive for self-employment. I think beyond some things which may be specific to entrepreneurship or specific to some of the things that we want to support, I mean, a great big incentive to self-employment in general, it's hard to see what public policy outcome that's trying to achieve. So I don't think moving a bit in that direction would create economic problems in the way that I think you're suggesting.
Jeremy, perhaps I could turn to you, both in terms of this assumption, this disincentive to self-employment, and also in a sort of form where perhaps as Treasury Minister, this concept of public engagement in it.
Yes. So I think when Paul described public engagement on acceptance for change of taxes as being very tough,
This is the greatest understatement that Paul Johnson has made in the last 12 months. But as a, forget as an ex-Treasury minister, as a backbench MP, I mean, I could show you hundreds of emails and letters that come in from constituents that said, you know, particularly at the time, 2010 to 2012, you know, I totally get the need for fiscal restraint. I totally get the fact that we've got a terrible deficit and we absolutely need to bring in. And I totally get the fact that we need to reduce public spending and increase taxes. And I support all the measures, apart from this one. And of course, it's a different one for everybody. And it's often the one that affects them most. In truth, there is a good argument against every tax. And anyone who's ever studied, you know, undergrad or A-level economics can list them out what they are. And in the end, it's our business taxes. I mean, again, we get, as MPs, you get a lot of correspondence saying how business rates are a bad idea, or you know, payroll taxes, national insurance is a bad idea. In reality, we end up having a blend of taxes because there are advantages to business rates, like the fact that it's quite certain. It's very difficult to hide a building. But there are disadvantages because it's like a fixed cost, and so therefore a profits tax, I suppose, we have a little bit of that, and we have VAT as a sort of sales tax. And that's kind of how the tax system works. And any economist who was writing, you know, from scratch, a sort of a theoretical, you know, incentives-neutral tax system wouldn't come up with the tax system that we've got, probably, or any other economy in the world. The reality is you have to, as I say, you have to have a blend. Interesting question on the, is man's and woman's default position to want to be self-employed? And it's all about transaction costs and all the rest of it. Again, there's a sort of economic theory answer to this, and there's also a practical answer. I say an answer. There's an argument. No one really knows what the real answer is. But I think there are lots of reasons to believe that, you know, so the joint stock company is a great invention for spreading risk to investors to make things happen in the economy. There's been less attention paid to whether the company that then emerges, the company of people, actually may itself be a force, a positive force for good over and above the contributions of those individual people. The company also spreads risk among those people. But it also creates a sense of camaraderie. There is a social function to going to work that makes you keep on coming back. There may even be a motivational factor of belonging to something, and particularly for, you know, a big brand and something that you see as doing some good in the world. So I'm not sure we can say there is that default assumption. It certainly is the case that there are some economic advantages to having people collaborating and so on in close proximity. You can do that in different ways. You can do it through cooperatives. You could do it just by having a big warehouse in the canals area of Manchester and saying, well, self-employed people, come and work. It just so happens that doesn't really happen. People are attracted towards working in a company with other people. And so to some extent, I think we don't need to unpack why that is. We just need to understand that for a lot of people, that is human nature.
Claire? Yeah, just to add really on that policy-making point. So I think it's incumbent on all of us, really, I think, to have that debate. But I think the point is, it's worse by this rabbit-out-of-the-hat approach we have at a budget time, where some new announcement, we haven't even been thinking about something, is suddenly announced, and, you know, that's the direction set. And then, you know, I think it's great the government consults on proposals, but we've already kind of set some of the policy of that announcement, and we're just then working out some of the detail. I think we need to start the debate much earlier, and so then it's incumbent on everyone from the sort of the tax professionals to the public to engage in that and to share those views. But if we did it much earlier, then by the time we actually got the announcement, we'd have already had a bit of that debate. And on those other points, you know, I definitely think we need proportionality, and we need a system that doesn't put too high a transaction costs. And I wasn't, like, I don't know if it came across as I wasn't actually advocating any of those solutions. I was just putting out some of the options that are out there and the pros and cons of them, because I really don't think there is a perfect solution, and that's why we need to debate it.
Thank you. Further questions, please. Gentlemen here at the front.
Clark Kelly. I'm a self-employed tax advisor. And the question is about the fairness of NIC. No doubt when NIC was thought of and established the risk-taking of the true entrepreneur was a real factor. Now, several of the speakers have almost equated the risk, the true entrepreneurs with the gig economy participators. But I think it would be wrong to just try to amend the self-employed NIC, NIC NIC, because the true entrepreneurs still carry very heavy risks, very heavy financial risks, and long hours. Maybe the answer in the is this dependent contractor or something like that with the gig economy to make a distinction.
Thank you very much indeed. Daniel, please.
Daniel Lyons, Deloitte and CIOT. The panel have talked at length about lost or potentially lost national insurance contributions. I wonder if they'd like to comment on the potentially lost VAT that we see, where a number of platforms are obviously disaggregated because each individual contractor, for want of a better word, is trading below the VAT registration threshold. And possibly comment slightly on the fact that a leading London tax barrister is taking a case against one of these platforms demanding a VAT invoice for his journey.
Thank you. Stella, please.
Hi, it's Stella Amos from PwC. I think technology might be one way of trying to broaden the engagement a little bit. I'm not an expert, but I think there's more we could do to think about how we use technology to engage more of the population on the tax debate. That wasn't my question. My question was really whether, just take it in a different kind of tack, do we think hypothecation, so allocating kind of specific tax kind of revenues to a specific kind of need, could help with that kind of public engagement because people might get bought into the tax system more easily?
Thank you. Damien, perhaps I'm going to start with you, both sort of hypothecation, fairness of national insurance. I'm not sure I'll actually speak about lost VAT. But
so, no. I guess tax hypothecation, we're possibly drifting slightly away from the topic of the day. But I mean, I think there is something in what you say that there is. You can make the argument for hypothecation to increase acceptance of tax. On the other hand, hypothecation also carries disadvantages with it. There is a danger that more and more things get hypothecated, and that leaves less flexibility and so on. We do already have sort of hypothecation of various rules around various things. I wanted to just briefly mention the gentleman was talking about on risk. In reality, there's a range of risk for even within different employed occupations. Some jobs have more job stability and so on than others. And then within the self-employed population, there are some jobs which have more income fluctuation, and there are different models of engagement which have greater or lesser risk. So I think that there is this continuum. Of course, a lot of people who are engaged in building a business, I mean, they'd be setting up a company, and that's a different set of structures, a different set of tax rules, and all the rest of it from those people who are working individually as a self-employed person.
And perhaps the concept of fairness of national insurance, and whether it's a fair system of taxing people.
No, taxation is a matter for the Chancellor and the Treasury, and not for the Department of Work and Pensions. So I'm not going to give a view specifically on that. I mean, I would come back to what I was saying earlier. You know, in reality, we have a balance of how we do tax.
So on that self-employed point, I do think it is important to. I think there is a distinction between the self and employed. I do think it makes sense to have a different treatment because, for the reasons you mentioned, around they're taking the risk, I think it's a very different position. But then also, you could say that what's the returns to a self-employed person isn't just sort of a labour return, there's also a return on investment, and we don't have national insurance on return on investment. So another argument is you could say, well, really what you have is you have a lower rate in total production insurance, but on a much wider base, because it's on the whole of the profits. So there's another argument as to why you should have a difference for the entrepreneur. The point on VAT is a good point. It's not a new point, of course. You know, we've had some, you know, your black cab drivers have for many years been self-employed and below the VAT limit. So it's not a new one, but it is something that needs to be considered as part of this. And I think we do have one of the highest VAT thresholds. Now, the good thing about that is it avoids sort of unnecessary compliance burdens, but it does have those knock-on consequences. So again, something that needs to be considered.
Cool. I won't. I mean, I'll just say something about the hypothecation question. My traditional view is very similar to the Treasury's traditional view, which is that hypothecation is almost by definition a fraud. If you say you're going to hypothecate national insurance revenues or VAT revenues or 2% of income tax to something, say it's the NHS or education, well, you're either going to spend up and down according to what your revenues are, so you kind of halve the NHS next year and double it the year after according to your revenues, or you're not. And if you're not, then it's not hypothecated. So that's my sort of fundamental view. That said, maybe, in a sort of third best world, we have to start fooling people into paying tax if we're going to pay for the public service of the realm. That's essentially what happened in whenever it was 2001, 2002, when the Labour Party put up national insurance to pay for the NHS. And that's a sort of hypothecation where you just say we're going to raise tax in order to spend more on something, and actually just being clear. It's sort of, you know, that's not a real hypothecation. We just be clear to say, look, we think our priority is this and this, and in order to fund back, we're going to do this to the tax system. Well, maybe that's the way to bring the sort of, to square the circle a bit in terms of the relationship, in terms of the how you get public engagement. The problem will always be the one that Damien referred to, which is whatever tax you refer, you increase to pay for whatever it is you want to support. Lots of people say, "Well, why that tax, and why not another tax?" So, I think, as I say, if you'd asked me a few years ago, I'd have dismissed it out of hand. I think I'm slightly more open to it on the grounds that I haven't found a better answer.
I think we've got time for one more round. Gentleman at the front here.
Michael Soholes, sole practitioner accountant. Just a couple of observations, really. One of the things about the tax system is it does, of course, need to be policed and adequately policed. And I think a big problem we face now and have for some years is that HMRC, and I'm not a particular fan of theirs, but they are under resource. Their numbers are too low. They're frankly overwhelmed in some areas by dealing with a backlog of cases involving, you know, various sort of artificial schemes for avoiding tax. And below that, even at the smaller business level, the degree of monitoring and control and routine inspection of a lot of small companies' records is much lower than it used to be. And if we could address this point about adequately resourcing the revenue at every level, perhaps we could increase the tax take by just that measure alone. Thanks.
Two gentlemen there.
Hugo Martin, Head of Legal and Public Affairs at Hermes Parcelnet, probably the second largest offerer of self-employment in the UK. Just a question to the panel about unintended consequences, really, of some of Taylor's recommendations and some of the things you've said this evening. So if we value flexibility and the worker status / dependent contractor status is designed to give that flexibility, taxing it as an employee would mean that companies would be faced with the same cost as an employee, but having to live with limitations of not being able to exercise control over them. So it seems to me that they wouldn't be used. The companies would therefore employ those people, which would then lead to, say, quite a massive loss of working opportunity. So if you have, say, 50,000 self-employed / workers, companies would then be forced to reconfigure their models to the extent that there would be a lot less work opportunity, a lot less people actually in work. So I wondered whether the panel had any views on that.
Thank you. And your colleague next to you, I think, he still has it. The same question?
Same one.
Any other people, gentlemen at the back there?
So it's just about just thinking about the tables about high enough insurance for employed, not self-employed. I was thinking that a related point is that we now have the auto-enrollment pensions, and people who are employed are by and large getting employer contribution on that, self-employed aren't. I was wondering if the panel thought that, because it seems to be in some ways brought in to deal with how large scale people not planning 40 years ahead, if the panel think it would be worth extending that to self-employed, or if they're more of the view that one's better phrase, self-employed know what they're doing, and you should probably be left alone to save or not save the pension as they wish.
Paul, perhaps I can start with you.
Yeah, that's a big question, this issue of auto-enrollment. I mean, it's one of the many other ways in which the self-employed and employees are treated differently. So one part of this is actually with all of the additional rights and responsibilities that come with being an employee, of which there are becoming more and more over time, you're making the difference between being an employee or a worker and being self-employed bigger. And that difference has clearly grown over time as the tax system has changed, as employment rights have changed, as what you're referring to in terms of auto-enrollment has changed. And I think that's a problem, because that then leads to huge issues for, you know, here is the line and you're either on this side or this side. In terms of in terms of whether you should auto-enroll the self-employed, in principle, yes. I mean, why not? I mean, why, in what way? I mean, as we've just been discussing, very, very many of them, the majority, look in many ways very much like an employee. Now, what I don't know is what the practical implications of that would be and how you would do it. And it seems to me the practicality there must be the kind of determining feature, whether you can do that very straightforwardly or not.
Claire? So the point on HMRC resourcing, I mean, clearly it's a really important issue, and their level of resource has been cut. But then again, it's made worse actually by the moving of the economy towards self-employment, because PAYE is very efficient from HMRC to collect. So, I mean, I'd really go up and say is yes, it's a very important issue that HMRC is sufficiently resourced.
Yeah. Thank you. So, yeah, I mean, on all of those things, first of all, look, on pensions, it is the case that people close to retirement, those who are self-employed, have lower on average, I mean, significantly lower on average accumulated retirement pensions than those who are employed. That's partly connected with the fact that median earnings for self-employed people was lower than for employed. But the structural question, I think, is an important one to ask as well. So there's a review of auto-enrollment going on at the moment, and self-employment is going to be part of that. It would be wrong of me to anticipate or second-guess the government response to the Taylor Review, which will come forward in due course. But I just wanted to finish on HMRC. Look, HMRC has had an awful lot of success as well over the last few years in recovering tax due. And our country has a very good record, actually, on publishing the tax gap. And the international organisations that look at these things tend to be very complimentary, actually, about what the UK does in terms of that. And being very transparent, the tax gap has come down. So, in fact, we are collecting much more of the tax that is due. Of course, there's always more that can be done. And, of course, any Chancellor is going to want... You know, the idea that there's tax element not being collected, that a Chancellor is not bothering with, for want of a little bit of Dell spend. I mean, that's not the case. And there are various, if you look over budgets gone by, there are various line items you can find in the red book that comes from the budget of, you know, programmes that HMRC are going to undertake to recover more tax and some of the cost that goes with that. And those have had quite some success. But of course, there's always more to do.
Well, I'm afraid that we've come to the closing point where that's all we have time for. Firstly, I found that a fascinating debate, so I think it would be good to thank all of our speakers on your behalf. Thank you very much. We have to be out of here by about 7:15, so we've still got about 10 minutes or so while speakers are moving. If you'd like to join us for another glass of wine, or some nibbles at the back, please do. But thank you all very much for coming. I hope you've enjoyed it.
Thank you, John.
Thank you. Thank you.
Yes, that's good.